How many of you ever played a game called Truth or Dare growing up? Let me see your hands. Okay, almost everyone. Now, if you're from another culture, it's possible you've never heard of this game. The game Truth or Dare is a very high schoolish game. Some people still play it in college, but generally it appeals to high schoolers. And the rules are very simple. Let's say that you and I are playing, and it's my turn to ask the questions. I would ask you very simply, truth or dare? And then you have to pick. Now, if you pick truth, what that means is you have to answer honestly any question that I ask to you. But you're picking truth, not knowing what questions I might ask. This may be a little bit abstract, so I'll make it more practical. Desiree, would you be willing to stand up and answer a question? I totally didn't expect you to do that. This is great. Desiree, have you stopped dealing drugs? Yes, well, I don't know. No, thank you. But she has to answer. That's a trick question, by the way. Traditionally, have you stopped beating your wife is the way it's phrased. But, that just seemed wildly inappropriate. So the bottom line is you never know what someone's going to ask you. So it's very, you saw Desiree. I mean, she flinched. She's like, oh, good Lord, he's going to humiliate me in public. Now, the thing about truth or dare is there's like a predictable set of questions that tend to emerge in a given group over time. For example, what's one thing you've always kept secret? Until now. Have you ever farted on a date? Who do you have a crush on? If you could go on a date with anybody in the world, who would it be? And the dreaded follow-up, if you could go on a date with anyone in this room, who would it be? Now, questions like that make most people think maybe dare is a better option. But then you start thinking, well, what would dare entail? Dare means I'm going to do whatever this person asked me to do, no matter how scandalous or stupid or life-threatening. So, Yilin, would you be willing to be our dare for the evening? I'm just kidding. Yilin would, I do not think, do that. So, now there's some innocuous ones, like I dare you to try a handstand, which, you know, would probably be humorous, but not really threatening unless you're really inept. But usually with high school students, it gets sketchy pretty rapidly. I dare you to kiss a mirror passionately for 30 seconds while I hold a video camera. Strip naked and run around the house screaming, born to be wild. That's why I'm not on the worship team. Or call your secret crush revealed in the previous round. Reveal your feelings for them on speakerphone. Dare has got its own set of problems with it. Now, in general, if you're playing with friends, it never gets too out of control if you have good friends. Generally, you'll sort of have a chicken option where you'll be like, look, man, give me another day. That just is ridiculous. Or a truth, I'm not going to tell you that. Try again. That's just out of the bounds. The thing is, we wind up playing Truth or Dare not just as a game, but for real every day of our life. This was really driven home to me late last quarter, about 4 months ago, just before the summer. Many of the Christian ministries all joined together. And with Mosaic taking the lead, we co-sponsored an event called the Veritas Forum. Veritas, if you remember your SAT Latin drills, is the Latin word for truth. And it's exactly that. We're trying to present truth in the person of Jesus Christ to the college campus. So we brought in some really big name academic Christians. Like, we're trying to bring intellectual credibility to the faith to demonstrate, not necessarily prove it's true, I don't think that's attainable, but to demonstrate its plausibility, that it could be true. There is nothing in Christianity that intrinsically offends against reason. So we brought in people like the philosopher from the University of Southern California, Dallas Willard. We brought in Gary Habermas, a very distinguished apologist. We brought in all these really big names, Michael Behe, an intelligent design theorist, who was very controversial. Actually, the first time I've ever seen biology professors picketing a meeting. Hardcore. And that was truth, and I was very excited. And I went home after that week, and I was just thinking, for a few solid days there, we really gave students something to think about. That was great. And then I showed up on campus that Monday, I grabbed the Stanford Daily, and I looked, and I was shocked. We had gone from truth to dare in the span of a weekend. Playboy was coming to campus to do their annual Girls of College photo shoot. And they were recruiting Pac-10 girls, Stanford students among them. And so they were holding auditions on campus. And that was bad enough. But I was really shocked when I looked at the editorial page on a following day and the editorial board. Now, this is not a lone op-ed columnist. This is like the editorial board of the Stanford Daily all got together, and they said, and I quote, I wrote this down, the prejudice against pornography is an unfortunate tendency in our society that should be corrected. And they went on to make the case that Playboy was a fine, upstanding literary magazine, which I suppose every male reads for the articles. And I was just grieved the next day as I got the San Jose Mercury News, one of the local papers. And, you know, they just thought it was hilarious, you know. Stanford girls disrobing, you know. The cream of society becoming the cream pies on the page or whatever. And so they interviewed these girls who were posing for the magazine. And they interviewed this one girl. I forget her name. I'll call her Deborah. Deborah was in line waiting to be photographed. And the journalist was just like, I'm fascinated by your decision. Have you thought about the long-term consequences of your decision to pose naked in Playboy? She's like, what do you mean? Well, like, for example, if you ever run for political office, this could have negative consequences. And she said some words that just stuck in my mind. You know, I guess I really hadn't thought about the consequences all that much. Boom, it just shot. I mean, you know, she's a bright girl. She got in here. She was an upperclassman. I mean, she's over 21. She's posing in Playboy. She's made it here. And yet, she hadn't really thought about the consequences of the dare. And she'd completely forsaken what I would consider to be truth. Now, that may sound like an extreme example at first blush, but if you've lived here any length of time at all, like, say, 10 days in the dorms, you know that you have to make truth or dare calls all the time. Will I live with integrity towards what I consider to be righteousness with that aspirational goal, knowing I'll never fully make it, but will I at least try? Or will I opt for the dare? Will I conform to the peer pressure? Will I allow others to determine my behavior? Now, I'm assuming that you're here tonight because at some level, you want to pursue the truth option. You're not so enamored of the dare. You're maybe even wrestling with it, but the truth is appealing to you. And you believe that in some meaningful way, the truth is revealed in Jesus Christ. Well, that's why Chi Alpha is here, to help you work through that. Some nights we'll talk about it just intellectually and sort of some reasons you might consider that more. We'll address you as seekers. I'm assuming that because you're here at the very first meeting of the school year, probably the vast majority of you have some sort of Christian background or previous Christian experience. And you're finding it challenged at Stanford and you want some help on the way. I'd like to give you some help tonight. I'm going to give you the keys, I think, to navigating this minefield that we call the farm successfully. And you got in here presumably because you had a pretty good GPA. Well, I want to give you the keys to having a high spiritual GPA here at Stanford. GPA is an acronym. Stands for God, Peers, and Authority. As you maintain your relationships properly in each of these areas, you'll be well-equipped to surmount all the obstacles and the challenges that you'll face here at Stanford. There's a story in the Bible that if you've been around Chi Alpha at all, you've probably heard me mention at least once. It's one of my favorite stories in the entire Bible. It's in the book of Daniel, chapter 1. And I've got it up here on the screen for you to look at. We're going to read verses 1 through 20. It's a lot, but bear with me. This is extremely relevant to where you're at this week. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia and put in the treasure house of his God. Israel got spanked bad. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of his court officials, to bring in some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility, young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace, men such as myself. He was to teach them the language. Don't laugh so hard, please. He was to teach them the language and the literature of the Babylonians. The king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years, and after that they were to enter the king's service. What just happened? They got enrolled in the University of Babylon. They're to undergo a 3-year pre-programmed course of studies with a careful screening admissions process. Got to have pretty high ancient SAT scores to get in here. You got to be really buzzed. You got to be the cream of the crop. And the 3-year course of studies you're undergoing is emphasis on the humanities and the social sciences designed to prepare you for careers of societal leadership. They went to college. Now, you think Stanford's bad sometimes. They're at the University of Babylon. Babylon, the byword for sin in the Bible. Like in the book of Revelation, the symbol of all that is arrayed against God. That's where they're going to college. What happens? Among these were some from Judah. This is the Frosh class. Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, the class of like negative 709 or whatever. The chief official gave them new names. To Daniel, the name Belteshazzar. To Hananiah, Shadrach. To Mishael, Meshach. And to Azariah, Abednego. They're trying to change their identities, to rip them from their culture, and to indoctrinate them into a new way of approaching life, even to the extent of changing who they consider themselves to be. But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine. And he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself this way. Now, God had caused the official to show favor and sympathy to Daniel. But the official told Daniel, "I am afraid of my lord the king," you know, the guy with the sword, "who has assigned you food and drink. Why should he see you looking worse than other young men your age?" Incidentally, we asked that same question, hence the sweetness party. "The king would have my head because of you." Daniel then said to the guard, whom the chief official had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, "Please test your servants for 10 days. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink," very much unlike our party. "Then compare our appearance with that of the young men who eat the royal food, and treat your servants in accordance with what you see." So he agreed to this and tested them for 10 days. At the end of 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the royal food. So the guard took away their choice food and wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables and said, "To these 4 young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning, and Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds." At the end of the time set by the king to bring them in, the chief official presented them to Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them, and he found none equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's service. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. They went to the most elite educational structure of their day, the equivalent of a modern-day tier 1 university, that was not just mildly ungodly, that was actively constructed in pursuit of a pagan god. I don't know if you've ever had occasion to read the language and the literature of the Babylonians. I myself have had some of that pleasure. When I was in grad school, I went to seminary. It's grad school for ministers. At one point, I read a little bit of this, and it's not like, I don't know what you think, like Harry Potter, Gone with the Wind, something like that. No, this is like books of praise to the Babylonian gods. These are the founding myths of their culture that these young men are studying and that they master and that they demonstrate their knowledge of to the king's satisfaction to an astounding degree, and that they leave this university not just surviving in their faith, but thriving in their faith by virtue of keeping up their spiritual GPA, their relationship with God, with their peers, and with their authorities. Let me talk about those very briefly. God. Jesus was once asked, "What's the key? What's the cornerstone of it all? If you have to boil it down, what is it?" And he said, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength." Right there, GPA God. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. And then he wanted to say, of course, love your neighbor as yourself. But this is the heart of what it means to live life fully, to live life in the way that we were designed to live it. Daniel and his friends did this very intentionally. It says Daniel resolved not to defile himself. Daniel had simple choices to make, and he made them very starkly. He knew what the consequences of even giving in on small things would be in the long run. It would be just like a plane that was flying from here to New York that was off by 1 degree. It would wind up in a completely different part of the country, maybe even in Canada. A small deviation at the beginning leads to a large deviation at the conclusion. And so Daniel resolved, you know what? They want me to violate my dietary laws. That's sort of a small thing. I could give in on that. I mean, after all, it's not like I have kosher food to eat. I got to become a vegetarian, which, by the way, was not a popular choice in the ancient world. Not sort of chic like it is now. Very, very weird to eat just vegetables. That's why the court official freaked out. He's like, "What, are you nuts?" But they chose to forego everything but the small amount, subset of food that would be acceptable to God. And they chose to, as much as it was within their power, to honor God with their lives. But you guys have a lot of choices to make over the next few weeks. Some you've already made. Others you will continue to make on a daily, weekly basis. One of the most important choices that you make is very subtle and may even elude you. But I can pretty much predict how you'll be doing with God with maybe a 75% degree accuracy based on one simple statistic. How many units are you going to carry this quarter? I mean, that is a choice that has consequences. If you're serious about wanting to live a life that is honoring to God, then you're serious about wanting to live a life that is filled with discipline. For example, with dedicated times of prayer, with times of reading the Bible, with times of gathering for corporate worship. You know what? If you carry 20 units, and they're real units, not like, you know, I don't want to name a class in case it's one that you find hard, but... But if you're doing something with a lot of problem sets, or, you know, maybe a language class that meets every day, it's a pretty, you know, you're doing a lot of those. You know what? You're going to have a really hard time carving the chunks out of your schedule that you need to be able to do something like participate in a Bible study, or to hang out with Christian friends and just talk about, man, I'm going through the ringer right now. My mom and my dad, this, and my brother, and my roommate. They don't understand. They've never had a roommate before. They don't understand this concept of my stuff. I want to kill them, but that whole turn the other cheek thing makes me think that's probably not right. I was doing my devotion out of the Ten Commandments, and it said don't kill, but I think he meant, like, don't kill chickens or something, because I really want to kill her. You know what? You have to make choices. And sometimes there will be a tension between your academic GPA and your spiritual GPA. And you've got to make that call. Now, I'm not saying, if you know me at all, which I know many of you do not yet, I am so not into arbitrary rules and legalism and just, you know, do it my way. Look, God has a relationship with you, whether or not you have one with him. God has a relationship with you, and he is clearly able to make his will known to you. But it's important that you take his will into account. Maybe 20 units is the right choice for you right now. I don't know that. But I do know you need to at least think about what will the ramifications of these choices be for my spiritual health 1, 2, 3 months down the road. Because I've seen enough students walk on this campus thinking, because your whole life you've been above average, way above average, that surely what everyone's saying will happen will not happen to me. And all the sophomores are thinking, for the first time, you really are average. In at least several courses, you're average. You won't be setting the curve anymore, unless you're just a freak of nature, in which case I commend you. It's going to be hard. And you need to think these things through. Now, that's God. You see, to this point in your life, if you were at all raised in the church, which probably most of you were, you've had a whole system developed to nurture you spiritually. Probably you had a youth pastor who was wild and crazy and had you eat bananas with your toes and stuff. And you had a... How am I different, by the way? I know calculus. I thought that was funny. Maybe not. You had a... You know, you were probably living with your parents the entire time you were at home, and probably they were Christians statistically, probably 80% of them or so were. They were pouring into your life. They were making you hold fast to certain rules. Every support structure in your life just got ripped away from you. You moved here. Boom, they're all gone. Every one of them. And now you have to own your own spiritual development. You have to assume responsibility for your own spiritual health. And for many of you, you've never done that before. It's challenging. I want to draw attention to one thing. Jesus said, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. It's a commandment. That means it is doable, and it is up to us. How that looks will be up to you. We'll talk more about that this quarter. Some things we might do that would help us to love God better and to show our love for God better. That's only one part, though. If all you do is love God, you won't love God for long. There's no way. You know what Satan calls Christians try to serve him in solitude? Hors d'oeuvres. He is a roaring lion looking for whom he may devour, and you look pretty darn tasty when you're hanging out by yourself. The next component is your peers. Knowing other believers who are going to walk down the road of life with you and are going to be helpful to you along the way. Two verses in the Bible stand out to me. 1 Corinthians 15:33. Don't fool yourselves. Bad friends will destroy you. I've seen that happen so many times. Proverbs says it another way. Wise friends make you wise. Hang out with fools, another translation says, and watch your life fall to pieces. you have choices to make in the area of relationships. Now, I'm not saying be a snobby, you know, holier than thou. I don't associate with the unclean. You know, tell your roommate to ring a bell anytime they come in the room. Unclean, unclean. I am a spiritual leper. No, that's just wrong. Jesus was a friend of sinners. So what is this saying? Okay, we all know you have levels of friendship, right? There are people who, like, we might say it today, you have acquaintances, you have friends, and then you have that inner circle. The ones who really affect you and whom you really affect. That's who we're talking about here. Now, I know it's real tempting. You just got ripped away probably from maybe all but one person that you knew before coming here. Maybe everyone. And that leaves a hole, and you want to fill it. Don't be too quick to fill it. I mean, real friendships take time to develop anyway. Give it a month or two. Get to know people. Figure out who you really resonate with at the level of values and at the level of chemistry. I mean, don't make yourself hang out with someone. Just, it'll be good for me, gosh darn it. Does that ever work? No. But if you look long enough, I promise you, I make you a promise on behalf of Jesus, and I'm not ashamed to do it. There is at least one person here for you. One person with whom you will click and who will also be an asset to you spiritually. Someone who will spur you on to love and good deeds. Find that person or people and get together with them. Now, obviously you're here, you're interested in staying a part of Christian fellowship. One of the biggest advantages to being part of a group like Chi Alpha, and there are many on campus, and I love almost all of them. Ask me about the other ones later. No, seriously, there are cults on campus, and you need to know that. If any group won't say what they believe, run. But check their website. And there's a clue, by the way. Here's the biggest clue you can find for a cult. If you Google for them, and there are more ex-member pages than member pages, that's a significant clue. Any organization that has more people who used to belong to it than belong to it now is not on the up and up. And there is at least one of those on this campus. It's not Mosaic or InterVarsity or anything. Chill. They're good. RUF is good. ABSK, love them all. But anyway, yeah. There's more than one. I don't want to just single one out and make you think all the others are safe. Check their doctrinal statement. Get to know them. But an advantage to a group like this is it is a ready-made place to find people who will probably be mutually beneficial relationships for you. And I don't mean that in, like, you know, the MBA marketing style, like, hey, here's my business card. You know, call me when you're president of IBM. I mean in the sense of someone who will be a boon to you, an encouragement. I think of some girls who came to our ministry early last year, freshmen, just like most of you. And they clicked with one another, and now they're all draw mates. That's the advantage of being in a place like this. You have a ready-made pool to draw from of people who will potentially be your roommates in the future. The draw system, by the way, is the way you pick your roommates in future years. You can kind of like, this year you got kind of assigned randomly. Next year you get to pick. Hallelujah. So there's your God, and there's your peers. And then the final category of relationships you really have to be careful with is how you relate to your authorities. God, peers, and authorities. Your authorities, you probably have three main categories of authorities. You got professors. Well, okay, first you got parents, right? You got professors, and you presumably have pastoral types in your life. Those are the three relevant categories I want to talk about quickly. First, your parents. You're of a generation that is like what my generation generally considers to be dysfunctionally close to your parents. like almost enmeshed. Now, that's a generational thing. I'm not saying it's good or bad, just that it drives most people my age up the wall. They're like, what is wrong with you people? You call home every day! Leave the nest! But in general, it is good that you love and honor your parents, and I want to encourage you to keep doing that. And if you're one of those people who you just have a bad family relationship, I might feel for you. I really do. But your parents are still your parents, and you have to find some way to honor them. That doesn't always mean obedience. One of the toughest things that will happen to you as a college student, as you go, maybe you go into grad school, as you're transitioning from like your freshman year to getting your master's, your PhD, is transitioning from being completely a child in the eyes of your parents to being an adult friend. That is hard. It's hard for them, and it's hard for you, especially if you're from an Asian culture and you have that whole notion of filial piety. It is difficult to figure out how to mesh that with your understanding of what it means to honor Christ with your life. And to follow after Jesus and to follow the Genesis thing of leaving your father and your mother and someday cleaving to a spouse, presumably, assuming you get married, which not everyone will. I was actually at a conference once, and this girl was talking about, you know, hey, you know, 99% of all people get married. What are the odds that you won't? And I just had to say it from the back of the room. I believe that'll be 1%, Jen. She was unamused. Some things you will learn, I have a mouth that there's often not a short circuit between my brain and the tongue. And so you will have wild and woolly times with me. But you have to figure that out with your parents. The next category is your professors. Now, here's the thing I want you to catch, going back to the story of Daniel. Now, of course, I didn't mention this to Daniel. It was so obvious, his friends. It was Daniel and his friends. They, it says in the Bible, they stood together. It says these four God gave. It was because of their togetherness that they made it. If Daniel had been by himself, I do not think there would be a book in the Bible called Daniel. But this one, authority. Did you notice how, even though Daniel and his friends were commanded to do something that was illegal in the eyes of God, that was a contrary to the spirit of the law, they didn't just say, no, my God is bigger than your stupid rules. What they said was, we understand that you're the authority here, and you have a right to tell us what to do. So let's see if we can work out a compromise that honors your authority and also honors my God. Here at Stanford, you're going to have occasion to do that periodically. Maybe in some of your classes. You'll have a film that you're assigned to watch that is just, for one reason or another, reprehensible to you. And, you know, pitching the hissy fit is very rarely productive. All it does is get you labeled as a religious idiot in class, which is generally not helpful to your witness. But you have to figure out some way to honor the legitimate authority that your professor has, and nonetheless honor God in the midst of it. And we'll talk more about that as the quarter goes on, some things that might look like. But you need to figure out how to relate to the authority structure here at the university in a way that, you know, I wish that the university felt that Christians were the best students to have in their classes ever, because they were the most helpful, the most compassionate, the most eager to do what was asked of them, rather than the first ones to bellyache about different things. Our reputation is more mixed. I challenge you to change that. If you keep up these three key relationships, your relationships with God, with your peers, and with your authorities, you know what? You're going to do really well here at Stanford. I can almost guarantee you, I can't see the future, but I can almost guarantee you that you'll graduate like Daniel and his friends, not just having survived the Stanford experience, but having thrived spiritually, with having a spiritual GPA that matches your academic GPA, and that you will be someone who will be a blessing to whatever church you wind up entering as you go out to get a job in, I don't know, Seattle and Singapore and San Diego or any other city that begins the letter S. You're not allowed to work in Los Angeles. Wherever you go, that in some way your pastor would be thrilled with what has happened in your life here at Stanford, instead of being someone who graduates very weak, if at all still in the faith, and becomes a mission field rather than a missionary to their culture. 2 Corinthians 5:20. We are therefore Christ's ambassadors. I want to help you be an ambassador to this culture. There's only so much I can do. I can give you good advice. I can pray for you, and I will. I can meet with you one-on-one, and if you ever want me to, I will. My email address, my phone number, my cell phone number is on our website, xastanford.org. Google for Chi Alpha at Stanford will be the first hit. My IM is on there. Get in touch with me however you want. Reply to all my emails. I'll meet with you. I will talk with you. I will counsel you. I will do whatever it takes. But in the final analysis, you're an adult. You're a free moral agent. And what your spiritual GPA is just as much up to you as your academic GPA. And it will take just as much work to maintain. I'd like to ask the worship team to come on up. I've asked them to close us with a song. And while we're doing that, you guys start playing softly. If you could take one of these and pass it around, and I will start another one at the back end here. If you will take one of these and pass it around, one for you, and if you would start, my apologies. Thank you. What these are is a chance for you to think about this tonight. Three key categories: your peers, your authorities, and of course, the ultimate category, God. I'm asking you to make some commitments to yourself. And maybe each of them is not for you. I think they probably are. But what I want you to do is to read over this card. It says, To maintain a high spiritual GPA, I will daily interact with God by praying and meditating on the Bible. I will daily interact with my peers through mutually beneficial friendships. I will weekly interact with my authorities, specifically your parents in this case, by calling them. Maybe you do it every day, but at least once a week, you will keep in touch. Email, IM, postcard, whatever's appropriate in your family. I will weekly interact with God, my authorities, and my peers by being part of a midweek campus ministry. I really, really do think that's important. And not just because it's my job, but because I've seen the difference it makes. And then I will weekly interact with God, my peers, and my authorities by being part of the ministry of a local church. We are not a church nor a substitute for a church. What we are is a special, we're like a SWAT team within the larger kingdom of God that's got a very specific focus that can help you answer certain questions that almost no pastor is prepared to help you answer because we have expertise. If you're willing, after we sing this song, I just want you to go through and check these. There's little boxes, put a check mark, and then off here in the corner, sign it and put your name and the date. Well, sign it and put your name. Put your name and the date. And just put it in your wallet somewhere, your purse or whatever you have handy, your pocket. And just maybe a bookmark in your Bible would be a great thing. And then, you know, you'll probably lose it. And then about 3 weeks, it'll tumble out of your Bible. And you remember, this is who I aspire to be here at Stanford. And wherever you're at, it'll kick you back into high gear, is my prayer. Also in here, we have a couple of little cards. We've got plenty of space left in this room. There is way room for your friends if they'd like to be a part. You probably each know at least one person who would at least be open to coming, whether Christian or not. Every talk is not like this, where I presuppose the belief of every person who is here. In fact, the remainder of this quarter, we're going to talk about the book of Colossians almost every week. Colossians is a book that talks about how to live your life, how to live your faith. In a place that is hostile to the gospel, where, you've ever heard that verse, do not be conformed or not be deceived by hollow and empty philosophies. That's in Colossians. That's one of the things it's about. And it talks to people, in part, who are far from God. This is a safe place to bring your non-believing friends who are interested in checking out Jesus. And if you don't believe us, go check out some of our previous messages online. I'm recording this right now. Pretty much every message we do goes on our website. So if you want, if your friend's nervous about coming, you just say, go check this out. This is what we talked about last week. Tomorrow night's a sequel. Please come. Just give this to them. Throw it in your wallet, throw it in your purse. And just whenever anyone asks you, when and where. It's very simple. In fact, I would encourage you, as we're singing this song, and after you've sort of done whatever you're going to do with this, maybe prayerfully think of a friend right now that God will lay on your heart that you're going to try to just say, hey, you know, I went to this really cool meeting this week. Maybe it's for you. You should check it out. Join me in prayer, and then we're going to sing a song. Father, we're here because we want to choose the path of truth, not the path of dare. There are so many opportunities to be conformed to this culture, to be pressed into the mold that other people expect of us, to do things just because they ask us to, and to deny the truth that we hold dear in our hearts. Lord, help us to be people like Daniel who resolve not to defile ourselves. God, people who will maintain those key relationships with you, with one another, and with the authorities that you have placed in our life to be a blessing to us, our parents, our professors, and our pastors. God, we love you. And tonight we commit once again to follow you. And if you've never made that choice before, tonight is a great time to make that choice. If you would like to begin following Jesus, just as this song is being sung, mean it with your heart. And that's all it takes. God looks on your heart, and if you mean it, you will become his follower. And I'd love to hear about that. Come and talk to me. Joel?